Session number 21295, Wheel 2.
Colonel McFetridge, Wheel 2.
On arrival in Digboy, Bill Fleming, the manager, he did not exactly greet me, because he said that he was not in favour of the policy of military arriving. It would cause unrest among his labour. He couldn't. His mission was to produce the maximum oil he could from the oil field, and he was afraid that the indigenous labour would quit, and there was nothing to stop many of them returning to their homes all over India. But he warmed to me because he was a fellow gunner, and he had served as a signaller on the Somme in 1916, and I think he was probably a very fine signaller of Royal Artillery. I was very fortunate in that the commandant of the Assam Valley Light Horse was on his staff, Major James Turnbull, MC, from World War I, and he assisted me to the very utmost. I was to report on possible gun sites. There were two obvious gun sites. One was to be on a site already cleared. It is very difficult country to find a space as large as a football field, which is what is required for an anti-aircraft gun site. Well, such space on level ground was very difficult to find. Two possible sites were the site cleared already for the manager's new bungalow, and it was hoped to build that very shortly. And the second site was the lawn tennis club at Digboy. It was quite obvious I wouldn't be very popular if I pushed that hard. I opted to go for two smaller sites, sighting just one Beaufort gun each. And deployed ultimately, or within 2 months, 3 months, on these sites, 18 pounders Mark I in an anti-aircraft roll. And the number issued to me was extraordinary, 5 guns. I said, why 5 and not 6 or 4? And I was told that this was all that could be found in the arsenals of India at that moment. So when the troops joined me, all raw recruits from Malaya, there came at the same time 5 18-pounders Mark I. And I was left to devise my own drill as to how these should be used on two sites, 3 guns on one site and 2 on the other side, in an anti-aircraft roll. And these guns arrived in an air of great secrecy. Of course, Japan had not entered the war. And I remember attending a drinks party given. These staff, mostly Scots, were very hospitable to me, and I attended a drinks party, and a lady came up to me and said, those guns which I saw arriving at Digboy railway station, they look very like the guns that were in my father's regiment when he was stationed on the Rhine during the 1920s. I didn't dare tell her that they were indeed those very same guns in an anti-aircraft roll in 1941. This indicates the total unpreparedness as regards equipment of India to meet an enemy who was likely to bomb their cities. It was an extraordinary life at Digboy, really. I lacked the normal support on a line of communication, and indeed I lacked the support of my own regimental headquarters at Karachi. I belonged to 1st Indian Heavy Attack Regiment. I commanded the 1st Indian Heavy Attack Battery at Digboy. And that, I had to point out, was very similar to a commandant in UK commanding a battery in Malta. Whereas in Karachi, there was virtually no rain. I used to receive directives telling me to dig slit trenches when the rainfall was 3 to 4 inches that day. And my regimental headquarters was in complete ignorance of the conditions at Digboy. This did not lead to amicable relations between me and my colonel. I was visited at Digboy by the GOC of Bengal and present and Assam district. He, after a cursory visit to the battery, he couldn't speak Urdu, he'd never served with Indian troops, and he was totally at loss with the conditions. He was from the British cavalry. And after visiting my battery, we went up in the car to meet Bill Fleming, the manager of the Assam Oil Company, who was the key man. I had never been ushered into the magnificent boardroom, which was arranged in tiers to accommodate perhaps 25 people. And with two, they were called stenographers, or would now be secretaries, to record the proceedings. And the general suddenly found himself on Bill Fleming's right and facing the top managers of the Assam Oil Company. And they had a series of very pertinent questions for him, such as who was to pay for the 6 soldiers admitted to the Assam Oil Company's hospital, who was to pay the bills locally. And Bill Fleming pointed out that he could spend lakhs of rupees without any authority, whereas Charles McFetridge couldn't spend one penny. And when he had invited Charles McFetridge to build a fence round his camp, Charles McFetridge had found that he was powerless to do it. This meeting culminated in very many difficult questions for the general and his lieutenant colonel's staff officer. And finally, he said petulantly, when he was serving in a cavalry regiment in Palestine in 1718, there was no grumbling when he and other cavalrymen had to take the horses down to water in 6 inches of mud. But because it could not be helped. And Bill Fleming turned to him and said, but the whole point of this meeting, General, is that it can be helped, and you are responsible for it. Thereupon, the meeting broke up, but it was brought home to the General and his staff officer that really the conditions in which the battery and I were operating were hardly reasonable. Can you switch off? No. It was fatal for the visiting general. General Broad, GOC Eastern Command, shortly afterwards visited Digboy. And in the afternoon, he was taken out to the breeding station where the Assam Oil Company bred oxen principally, and to show to the people of Assam the elements of breeding. General Broad suddenly saw a misshapen calf, and to his astonishment, he bore on its head, between its horns, the nameplate of this general who had previously visited. And when he asked the manager of the Assam Oil Company as to why it bore this general's name, he was told, because according to your general who last visited us, this calf represents the perfect calf. Well, in due course, the regiment at Karachi mobilized and went to Singapore and went into the bag. And that was the fate of the 1st Indian Heavy Attack Regiment. Hardly a good start to the raising of 37, ultimately, anti-aircraft regiments. I was relieved, and that is the word, by the adjutant of the regiment who was found to be medically unfit to go to Singapore. And I returned to Malaya cantonment. I, shortly before 1st Indian Heavy Attack Regiment left for Singapore, I applied, of course, for a posting, and I was posted to command 3 Indian Light Attack Battery, which was then being formed in September 1941. I found that the other 2 batteries in the regiment had been raised and had already had its recruits, but the battery I joined was only then, 6 months later, in September 1941, receiving recruits from the anti-aircraft training center. It is given to very few officers to raise a battery and to be within 4 months committed to a war, as I was with this battery in January 1942. The battery was steadily built up, but nevertheless the other 2 batteries in the regiment had a clear advantage that they were 6 months ahead of my battery. in early December 1941, the colonel of my regiment was ordered to send one battery to Calcutta at once, with a view to it embarking for an unknown destination. When I heard of this on a Saturday at Malaya, on a Saturday in early December, I thought, well, the other two batteries have got 6 months lead, and part I will play in here is to give perhaps some of my best officers and best Indian. Please don't forget that Punjabi Muslims were then in the Indian Army, and to give my equipment to complete the battery assigned for the task to go to Calcutta and thence overseas. So I went off to the club that night, convinced that I had no part to play in this. But when I returned to the camp at midnight, I saw lamps still burning in regimental headquarters office. This was unusual, so I put my head in, and I found the colonel with the adjutant working over a table. I asked him to excuse my intrusion, but it was unusual for all the lights to be on in regimental headquarters office. And he said to me, sit down here, you're the very man that I want to speak to. And he said, you will know that one of the batteries is to go to Calcutta with a view to service overseas. I find this a very difficult decision about the three batteries, because the three battery commanders are so dissimilar. One is commanded by a major from the Territorial Army, England, but he shows very little progress in learning Urdu, and I think he's rather past it. And the other one is a regular officer. He's just passed a course in anti-aircraft gunnery, but he has arrived very recently, and I have not much confidence in him being able to lead Indian soldiers. And the other battery commander is yourself. Well, you certainly can speak Urdu, and the soldiers and the Viceroy's Commission officers will know what you mean, and you know what active service means from the frontier, but you have no knowledge of anti-aircraft gunnery as it is now. Of course, I'd served in anti-aircraft gunnery in the UK and Egypt before 1938. And he said he found this a difficult decision to make, and he went off to consult the infantry commander of the group. We were nominally then in 1st Indian Armored Division. He told me that he and the brigadier, when it was explained to him, decided that they would each write the name of the officer or the battery on a piece of paper, and they would throw the paper in the middle of the table. Neither could influence the other on this issue, and they both chose the name of McFetridge. This, I may say now, I think was the right decision, because certainly in the campaign in Burma in 1942, it did need a very strong handling at times, and it needed a British officer who could communicate with his troops. And this was the choice of these two senior officers of the Indian Army of that day. that you should not commit Indian troops except under officers whom they knew well. The battery moved to Calcutta and immediately deployed straight on gun sites, which had been reconnoitred for me. I received then the orders that we would embark on Boxing Day, December the 26th. The destination was still not told to me, and this was about December the 15th. At the same time, I received a very personal, highly confidential letter from the GOC Calcutta, telling me that a squadron of a well-known Indian cavalry regiment had refused to embark at Bombay, and that I would be held responsible if there was any such movement amongst my soldiers. I was given practical suggestions, such as the bazaars were to be put out of bounds, and the troops were to be kept in camp, and as far as possible, busy, of course. Now, I had very junior officers with me, straight from officer cadet schools, and I had no one in the battery in which I could confide my worries. So I confided in the senior viceroy's commissioned officer. And he told me that I should hold an attestation parade by which the Indian Army soldier took the oath to serve the crown overseas, and that we should have a good, impressive attestation parade. This was not easy with the 12 guns of the battery deployed singly on the perimeter of Calcutta. But he and I determined this should be held, and we would do it on a gun. You needed a flat surface, and the best gun for the purpose was that on the flat roof of a huge warehouse in the docks of Calcutta. And he undertook to do it on December the 23rd, and that we were fortunate to have in the battery to do it a Malvi, the Muslim priest, who was a comparatively young civilian. But he would not come to Burma, and the Subedar, to whom I am ever indebted, said that he would speak to the Malvi, and he was sure the Malvi would play his part to the full. Well, arrangements had to be made on this gun, because the recruits take the oath by putting their hand on the barrel of the gun. You can have, I think it is 5 on one side of the barrel and 5 on the other side of the barrel, and each man has his right hand on the barrel, and he repeats after the Malvi the oath. I can only say that on December the 23rd, this was done, and subalterns of the battery have told me since that this was really a most impressive event. And they were greatly impressed, these newcomers, these officers who were newcomers to the battery. The Malvi entered his part so well that he exclaimed at times, "Zorse, Zorse, after Cousin Carlo. Speak your oath more loudly. And, of course, the attestation parade is recorded on every soldier's documents that he took the oath on this date. And the Subedar's point was that if there was any evidence required afterwards, there it was, in writing, that he took the oath on December the 23rd, and yet he was not present to embark on December the 26th. And I attribute much of the success of the battery afterwards to this advice that I was given. We embarked on December the 26th on the BNI ship, and I just now cannot remember its name. I found myself OC troops to, whereas I had hoped to have a rest, and I found myself detailing for the lifeboats, or who to be in charge of the lifeboats, brigadiers who were going out in staff appointments to Burma. It was a curious position to be in, that I, as OC troops on the ship, a major, found myself commanding brigadiers and colonels what they should do. The captain of the ship, when he heard that there were Bofors guns on board, he asked me whether I could put one gun on the on each deck, and I did so. It was during the 5 days' voyage to Rangoon, used for the purposes of gun drill. We were fortunately not attacked by Japanese aircraft. On arrival in Rangoon, we found that the docks were deserted because the Japanese had bombed the docks on Christmas Day. But the battery somehow assembled in a hide or in a wood some 15 miles outside Rangoon near Mingledon Airport. And as soon as two troops were assembled, they were deployed to protect Mingledon Airfield. And one troop left and moved by rail and boat over the River Salween to Moulmein. And this was our deep employment during January. One troop, two troops on Mingledon Airfield outside Rangoon, and one troop in Moulmein.